All right, everybody. Man, it is so good to see all of you. A lot of you came this morning to the 10 a.m. service, which is awesome. There's a lot for the 10:10. That's not a scolding, but that's just pretty great. I applaud that. We're here. It's summertime. It is good to be together. As our good friend Gene is modeling for us right here, we have Bibles. And if you need one, maybe raise a hand or we have them in the back. That's a good thing to have this morning at Mars Hill Bible Church. So always a good thing. And while that's happening, I just invite you to pray with me. God, would we be faithful listeners, faithful holders of your story? Spirit, would you remove barriers so that your word would be in us and that we can be in your story? Jesus, would you model for us what it looks like to live this out? We're thankful that you are with us and answer and hear our prayers. In Christ's name, amen. So, this past week, I was involved in an apocalyptic battle. For a couple days every year about this time, we go to war. And this is serious. The combatants are many. They're largely unseen. They're in the walls and in the floors. And they try and win. Ants. Anybody? Some ants this month, right? For us, it's a combination of, you know, 100-year-old home and kids who forget where their mouth is only during mealtime and who knows what else. And you see one, right? Just see one. You're like, ah, it's not a big deal. You're a cute little guy. You go on your way. Then you see two and three. And then the argument starts. Well, maybe if we just put a couple dabs of essential oils on a cotton ball. Or we're going to carpet bomb chemically the whole house. And there will be no in-between. Although we did go somewhere in between on that one. And it's amazing the distraction that this thing can do to you beneath the surface. And I knew that we would win, right? We would eventually conquer. And once they took the bait, the battle had been won. But quite honestly, in the meantime, it's just uncomfortable and gross. And to kind of persevere through the attack of these little things is just disgusting. So I pray you don't have to do that. And if you do, we have some bait recommendations and some breathing exercises to help you endure amidst the persecution, which are terms from Revelation as well. See that right there. Not quite as many beasts in our text today as there are ants in the walls, but there are lots of them. And we are slogging through the middle of the book of Revelation this morning. We're in chapters 12, 13, and 14. Never read at a wedding. I found that out. You can imagine. These chapters that we're in, they mark the middle of the book. You know, a lot of times you can look at ancient writings, especially in Psalms or Proverbs, and you see it where there's something special at the beginning, something unique in the middle that leads you out into something that resembles the beginning. They call it a chiasm or a chiastic reading. And so this is that middle point where the script shifts a little bit. Last week we dabbled a little bit in Revelation 11, where we see kind of Christ opens the seventh trumpet sounds, and we're assured of victory of God in the heavens, right? And we have heard this because in Revelation 11 it says, "And he shall reign forever," right? You might come back on Christmas Eve. You'll hear a better version. But that's where that text comes from. He will reign forevermore. The high point is God's victory. And then how does that happen is what we engage in the beginning of chapter 12. The assuredness of the victory of God. And yet we have to figure out how to live in the meantime. We move from anxiety to assurance in this text. But at the same time, this text is something that is revealing, pointing to something, empires, powers, forces in the world that are animating systems that we need to be aware of. We had a meeting a couple months ago as we were looking through this Revelation series, and with the short straw in my hand, I had Revelation and Politics, chapters 12, 13, and 14. All of the preachers have left town. I think Troy's on his way out the parking lot right now. And so we look at this, and not through the lens of, you know, American or Western party or partisan politics, although that's part of it, and I pray this helps lend some insight into how we engage those things. But the polis, the life of the politic, like, what are we doing together, and how do we engage powers and systems as such? So if you're looking for a partisan recommendation or any sort of allegiance statement, we're not going to find one today, and John doesn't offer us one in Revelation. In fact, in some ways, that seems like too small of an issue, although it permeates our culture, too small of an issue to try and contain what's happening in the spiritual realm into that, although one does inform the other. And it's a good time for us to engage this type of conversation. In years past, maybe like times before, and maybe different from times before, we've seen kind of the cracks in the political system and the promises that are laid empty on all sides and all polls. There is no political place in front of us that resembles the character of God in such a way that we can swear allegiance to it primarily. And so we followers of Jesus are in a unique space to discern how then do we live amongst the powers. And although there are powers there, they don't have power over us or in us unless we let them. Which is why this is a timely talk for us. A recent APA poll noted that 40% of Americans are more anxious today than they were a year ago. 20% of Americans have an anxiety-related diagnosis to get prescriptions for. We see the rise of addiction and distraction, hurriedness to be distracted, internal chaos leading to isolation. The 24-hour news cycle that we can get at any time in any place and immerse ourselves in, it's not doing great things to the American mind and soul. And probably not awesome things for you and I. In fact, if you're like me and you try and be enough to be up to date and aware and informed, it starts to do something inside of me. If I listen too long or get too worked up, I snap at other people. I mindlessly eat things as I get anxious about what's happening in the world. I'm not a great person to be around, because my hope in powers is distorted, and the hope is not where it should be. And John points us to some things like that today. We recognize that we're not in Revelation 19, 20, 21, 22, where, as those great words said and how great thou art, Christ will come and make his home. All things will be well, but we're slogging through that liminal space where it is not well, and we're hoping that it will be someday. Chapters 12 and 14 offer us a lot of visuals, and so instead of reading the entire text, we're going to employ our friends from the Bible Project to kind of give us a visual of this. So listen in, and we'll revisit some texts after this. This is going to pick up at the beginning of Revelation chapter 12. So enjoy, I guess.
With a series of visions that he calls signs. The word literally means symbols, and these chapters are full of them. These visions explore the message of the open scroll in greater depth. The first one reveals the cosmic spiritual battle that lay behind the suffering of the seven churches under Roman persecution. It's a manifestation of that ancient conflict that began in Genesis chapter 3. The serpent, who represents the source of all evil, is depicted here as a dragon. It attacks a woman and her seed. They represent the Messiah and his people. Then the Messiah defeats the dragon through his death and resurrection, and it's cast to earth. There, the dragon inspires hatred and persecution of the Messiah's people. But they will conquer the dragon by resisting his influence, even if it kills them. John's trying to show the churches that neither Rome nor any other nation or human is the real enemy. There are dark spiritual powers at work, and Jesus' followers will announce Jesus' victory by remaining faithful and loving their enemies just like the slain lamb. John's next vision retells the story of the same conflict, but this time in the earthly symbolism of Daniel's animal visions. John sees two beasts empowered by the dragon. One of them represents national military power that conquers through violence. The other beast symbolizes the economic propaganda machine that exalts this power as divine. And these beasts demand full allegiance from the nations, and that's symbolized by taking the mark of the beast and his number, 666, on the forehead or hand. Now, this is an infamous image, and you won't discover its meaning by reading news headlines. John's making a clear Hebrew Old Testament reference here. First of all, this mark is the anti-Shema. The writing on the forehead and hand, it's a clear reference to the Shema, an ancient Jewish prayer of allegiance to God that's found in the book of Deuteronomy. This prayer also was written on the forehead and hand as a symbol of devoting all your thoughts and actions to the one true God. But now the rebellious nations demand their own allegiance, and they force everyone to decide who they will follow. Then there's the number of the beast, which has fascinated readers for thousands of years. But this was not a mystery to John. He spoke Hebrew and Greek, and Hebrew letters were also numbers. If you spell the Greek words Nero Caesar and the word beast in Hebrew, each one amounts to 666. Now, John isn't saying that Nero was the only fulfillment of this vision. Nero's just a recent example of the ancient pattern set out by Daniel, that the nations become beasts when they exalt their own power and economic security as a false god and then demand total allegiance. So Babylon was the beast in Daniel's day, but that was followed by Persia, followed by Greece, and now Rome in John's day. And so it goes for any later nation that acts in the same way.
Trippy, right? So let's pick it up. Let's look a little deeper. If you have your Bibles, in the Shed Bible, at least it'll be on 11:45, which if you translate that into Hebrew, it means Timothy is a great preacher. Adds up to 11:45. Yeah, you can only do so much with these numbers, right? I mean, they're everywhere, right? Okay. So, Revelation 12. I'm going to pick up reading here at verse 5. She gave birth to a son, a male child who will rule the nations with an iron scepter. Her child was snatched up to God, to his throne, and the woman fled into the wilderness to a place prepared for her by God, where she might be taken care of for 1,260 days. And then there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. But he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. And the great dragon was hurled down. That ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray, he was hurled to the earth and his angels with him. We'll continue in a moment, but it's particularly important that we stop there and recognize what has happened. Echoing the victory of God in chapter 11 before this, we see this character, all of evil personified, cast down. Lost. The war to end all wars is essentially won. Now, John does something interesting here. In verse 9, he says, the great dragon was hurled down, the ancient serpent called the devil or Satan. He names this power. He gives evil a person and a name. And I've been more or less comfortable with that in different times in my theological journey. But it's important that we latch onto that here. Because, friends, as we talk about our engagement with the systems and powers that give shape to our daily life, it's important that we recognize that John is pointing at an evil one so that we don't look for evil in each other, right? And he says, there are demonic powers. And if we forget that, we tend to demonize one another instead. So it's a critical yet uncomfortable starting point that we say, there's an enemy. It's named. It's evil. And it's giving shape to part of this story for the time being. Let's continue. Verse 10, then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah. For the accuser of our brothers and sisters who accuses them before God day and night has been hurled down. They triumphed over him by the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death. Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you. He is filled with fury, because he knows the time is short. While evil has lost and is cast out of the heavens, it has a present power in the meantime, until Christ returns. So woe to those who deal with that. This prompts a lot of questions in me, not least of which, why? We're going to address that in a few minutes, but it's a real question. So we continue. This is chapter 13, verses 1 through 4. And the dragon stood at the shore of the sea, and I saw the beast coming out of the sea, and it had 10 horns and 7 heads with crowns on its horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard. It had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. And the dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have a fatal wound, but the wound had been healed. The whole world was filled with wonder and followed the beast. People worshipped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast. And they also worshipped the beast and asked, "Who is like the beast? Who can make war against it?" Let it not be lost on us that a few minutes ago we were singing, "Who is like the Lord our God," right? Who sits enthroned on high. And people are deceived to then ask, "Who is like the beast?" Right? Now the beast wants to be like Jesus. You get this interesting section, it's in verse 3. You get this patchwork of a picture of what this beast is like. And one of his heads, the beast seemed to have a fatal wound that was healed. Seemed to. The Greek there is very explicit that it's kind of an illusion. Because the one with the fatal wound who John keeps pointing to through this whole book, the lamb who was slain is the true power. And this beast is but a cheap imitation. Trying to slant and pervert our longing for God and saying, "Well, I can be like that." And to appear like Jesus is what John is getting at here. But don't be deceived. And then another beast comes. Right before that, we see this in 13. This is 13, verse 10. If anyone goes into captivity they will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword they will be killed. Then get this. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on behalf of God's people. In the middle of this chaos where the beast is ripping apart allegiances in families, in culture, given power to destroy, or death is abounding, John points to his patient endurance. And continue on, we see a second beast come up, right? The video showed us that, which gives praise and worship to the other two beasts and deceives people even more, where that's the beast of economy, or of perverted religion, some scholars would say. And then it changes gears after we get the 666 thing. I'm glad that video took care of that. Great. Good work. And then there's this 144,000, this multicultural army from all languages and places and people that God has assembled giving praise. And then these three angels make this announcement of the gospel, which also sounds terrifying. And at the end of that, this is 14, verse 12, this calls for patient endurance on the part of the people of God who keep his commands to remain faithful to Jesus. And the text continues on with some other imagery equally as terrifying. But in the middle of this, John is calling us to something. And we need to remember as we encounter this story that we're not trying to bend this story to our will, but instead bend our story to what God is saying. Right? That's our attempt here, is to not crack this as a code that makes sense of our preconceived notions of how things ought to be, but put ourselves under the scriptures, let them come in us so that we can see the world their way. I heard this story once. There was an old man sitting on a porch, I imagine, in Georgia. And he's sitting there with his cat, and he's petting the cat from tail to head. And somebody walks by and says, "Hey, man, you're petting that cat wrong." He's like, "Cat can turn around." And I was like, all right. So if it feels in some of this as if, you know, we're being petted the wrong way, should not, anyway, yeah, and we can turn around, we can change, and I hope that's what we do as a community, to shift into what God is doing and not just what we hope for our own selfish vision God will do. So in the testing and confusion of this particular text, I hope there's some places where we can identify, oh, that seems to be happening. We're in a time when there are powers that are calling for our allegiance, where there are systems animated that are oppressive and deadly and divisive, where there are families where you once thought you were together on something who it doesn't seem like you can talk to anymore. And we live in a contested space, as we've said week after week. That's exactly where John calls us to have patient endurance. Now, he says it twice in these two chapters, but he says it seven times, shocking, in the book of Revelation, right? Seven times he calls for the church, the people of God, to endure patiently. Again, chapter 13, 10, this calls for patient endurance and faithfulness. Chapter 14, verse 12, this calls for patient endurance on the part of the people of God who keep his commands and remain faithful to Jesus. In the face of all that's going wrong, in the face of powers unveiled, he says, patient endurance. Slow your roll, you might say to this. In the face of evil, that's what you say? Yes. Do you mean like thoughtful, metered, faithful, durable, intentional engagement? Yes. I think that's what John is calling us to. But it seems weak in the face of evil, doesn't it? And I recognize also that I stand here and we try and have in our view all the issues and brokenness and pain and dividedness of our world, and to have someone who, as a well-educated Western white male, benefits from a lot of that brokenness, to say, let's endure patiently, seems wrong. And just on that level, I'd agree, but the text is calling us to something that God has called to the oppressed ethnic minorities throughout centuries, the ones whose story make up the majority of this book. And so there's something more than someone who benefits, unfortunately, from broken systems saying, let's just endure patiently. And I don't think the patient endurance like that is what we think it means. Because patience is not passive in this case, and there's work for us to do. But the posture with which we do it really matters. And that's what I think John is getting at by putting patient endurance, bookending this idea of the mark of the beast. There's no physical mark. It's not an iWatch, Apple Watch, right? Whatever. It's not that. But it's a condition of one's heart. In the same way the Shema, forehead, hand, point to the condition of one's heart. That's where the beast gets inside and allegiance gets skewed. And so there's something deeper going on here when we talk about what patient endurance means. So let's look at a couple things. First, though, that patient endurance in this framework of powers does not mean. It doesn't mean, according to this text, to find your primary allegiance in our culture, right? Cultural allegiance is not being patiently enduring and faithful. And by that, I mean what we see here is the powers at B, could be any powers, right? People have been reading their political disaster cycle into this text for generations. And we'll do it again and again and again. And remember, this is bigger than a person or persons, but it's powers that are animating. Let's not demonize one another. But it's tempting to swear allegiance to the power. The church at its worst begins to worship false power, to be coerced by it, seduced into thinking that's the way forward. I get that. Right? There's practical outworkings of that. But that's not what John is calling us to here. This is a quote by scholar Daryl Johnson, who wrote a pretty good commentary on Revelation. He says, "Is this not what we see in our time? There are forces at work in our churches encouraging us to take our guidance for ethics and the way things are, from the way things are, instead of the way things are supposed to be as revealed in Jesus Christ. There are also forces so enamored with the powers at work in our culture that they encourage us to embrace as God's new work cultural norms which are clearly contrary to the reign of God. And there are forces at work uncritically supporting the use of violence to counter violence." It's tempting to align ourselves with whomever has the power. Throughout history, we see this repeated. Western church, Eastern church, all over the place. It's seductive. And yet, that's not what we see. It's dangerous, friends, for us to follow that line of thinking. Our beloved Ed Dobson, who's spoken here many times, says this in one of his books, "Whenever the church cozies up to a political power, it loses sight of its all-important mission to change the world from the inside out." And Jesus in Matthew chapter 10 says, "I did not come to bring peace, but the sword." And so there's something that doesn't make sense about this. It's not us just trying to make peace with whatever power may be, but to be critical examiners, patient endurers, who say this will pass, and I'm not to corrupt the church to find sociological power. Jesus could have aligned himself with Rome, the empire, and chose not to, and therefore died, and the disciples died, and God did something beautiful out of that. And so, friends, this is just a word of caution to all of us, no matter the time or political cycle we're in, to not find ourselves too cozy with power for power's sake. Now, what I'm not saying in any of this is to completely disengage from the world, right? In fact, in the midst of the original hearers of John's letter, who are hearing endure patiently, their mandate is still to love the sick, care for the poor, open their doors. So there's an engagement that's not passive, but it's patient. And on the flip side of this coin, maybe patient endurance is not a frantic freakout. This is another option in front of us, to respond to our scrolling, commenting news feeds with an unshakable, unquenchable anxiety that must overflow into every conversation and fix and address all the things right away. And this points to a franticness inside that leaks outside. I'm amazed at how in the face of persecution and what people thought was really urgent, Jesus has the interior capacity to be patient. We see this first prophesied, Isaiah 53, that the lamb before the slaughter is silent, calmed, right? In John chapter 8, Jesus is being questioned, and there's people brought before him, and there's all these a public dialogue, and he bends down, and he draws in the dirt. And I'm sure his disciples are like, what are you doing, man? Or like the time it got even more real when later on in John 11, when he's late to save Lazarus and Lazarus dies. People are like, man, if you'd hurried up, he wouldn't have died. And it's as if Jesus intentionally does not engage the trolls. He doesn't engage everything that pokes at him. He remains unfrantic and yet driven with incredible purpose. And so, friends, for us in this moment, I think it means in light of the powers that be in the way we engage them, patient endurance may look for us like being centered instead of frantic, to being deliberate, like what ants are actually in your house? You should kill them, right? Go after those. What can you put your energy towards? I think John is very aware that when these letters reach the churches, he's sending the book of Revelation to, that energy management is key. Friends, we as a church, we have a huge, high, and holy calling. And it's going to take all of us, and it's going to take a lot of energy. And I don't know about you, but I can expend energy frantically in a lot of fruitless things. But we're called to something greater together. So let our patient endurance not be freaking out. And let's channel something towards something greater. Patient endurance may, in fact, look a little bit like this. Intentional attention. We talked a few weeks ago how the average American attention span is now shorter than a goldfish. It was embarrassing. I take my kids, when my wife's like working out and eating kale, I take them to Donuts on Saturday mornings. Man, this is real vulnerable. And we walk downtown and we sit by the fish tank at Good Time Donuts in Holland. And my kids just love tapping that tank. And then sometimes they'll just look at those fish. And they beat the fish. Like, the fish just can't focus. And our attention is one of the most valuable commodities that we have, and also now in the world economy, when we see what's being bought, sold, and traded is not just data, information, but our attention. What are companies going to put in front of us to draw our attention to? And I want to say, what's being put in front of us to draw our attention from? The patient endurance of the church. Being attentive matters because attention is what we offer in worship. We tune our hearts to what God is doing here. We offer our attention in this space to God. And John's issue really for the rest of Revelation is, who will we worship? Who will I worship? Who will I adore? Who will get my attention? Who will get my undivided allegiance? Is it going to be Jesus, the slain lamb, or is it going to be the phony powers that are at best distortions, temporary distortions of what Christ is doing in the world? In the renewal of all things. So our attention matters. So much so that built in to our regular rhythm of our formation school last year, we had these feasts of attention, which is an ancient Christian practice, where we would pause, carve out time, come together, bring copious amounts of food, and pay attention. Pay attention to the image of God in one another. Pay attention to the story God is telling in and through you. Pay attention to the created order through the good food that is shared. Pay attention to the time that God has blessed you with. Pay attention intentionally to what God is doing. And that cultivates a spirit of joy and gratitude. So friends, what I want to ask us as we pursue patient endurance together in light of the powers, are there spaces that you are carving out where you can cultivate joy and attention to what God is doing? Are there spaces in your week or monthly rhythm where you can pause and pay attention to what God is doing? Literally think of one. We'll give you a minute. Where's the time this week where you can have a sacred pause and pay attention to the work of God in your story and that of others? The other thing that patient endurance seems to be pointing to in this text is rest. Now, I'm not saying that those of you who came in at 10:10 got rest, because when we come in at 10:10, it's not restful. It takes a while to get here. But rest is something we're called to, that God models for us. And there's two kinds of rest I'd like for us to look at real briefly. One is resting into a true reality. Resting into God. The victory of God. A couple weeks ago, we talked about these visions in Revelation, right? They're signs. They're pointing to a deeper reality. It's like if we could see the Wi-Fi around us, right, is one example we gave. We have an invitation then to rest into the reality we see in the text, the one where God is victorious, where God is living and at work, and Christ cares for his people, and the Spirit is alive, where he shall reign forever and ever, and the evil one is cast down. And God reigns. That is the true reality in which we are invited to rest into. It's also really hard. I know that because my life, like all of yours, is difficult and messy, and there's spots that do not feel like God is ultimately in control. And although the text says something different, there are times when it feels like death or evil has the last word. And I know this because one of the most sacred moments of my week, and I think for our entire staff, is when we open prayers with you and join them before heaven and ask God to do and come and be amongst us, to heal, to hope, to renew. So we sit in this tension, and yet we're called to rest into the final victory of God. I'm not sure what that looks like for you. I imagine there's a place that God is growing inside of you that is deeply secure and reminds you of God's final victory. The war is won, and evil has lost. Despite living in that space where we ask the questions of the reader of the parable of the wheat and the weeds, like, Lord, why are these growing together? Why don't you just come and wipe it all out or fix everything right now? Why do I have to live in the transition time where there's wheat and weeds together? And Christ says, I love them all. And that question of why is not a factual one, but a relational one. And I pray that it drives us towards deeper relationship with the one who holds all mystery. And we can ask a person why and journey together in that answer. So we rest into God's true reality. Maybe the flip side of that is to rest from reality. Let's get some blood flowing. Everybody go, let's go reality. Reality. Right? Yeah. One more time. Get the reality. Well done. Rest from the noise. Rest from the beasts demanding allegiance. Rest from the economic coercion they put in front of you. Shabbat Shalom, the call to Sabbath, is where we find our invitation in practice today. That patient endurance ultimately doesn't rest in our performance, but in our ability to tether ourselves to the character of God and find rest for our souls. Mark 6, Jesus says, come with me, away to a quiet place and find rest, right? My yoke is easy, my burden's light. We see this throughout the scriptures where the God who rested from work invites us into rest. And so the final question really is for us, if we're going to patiently endure and find ourselves with a right frame to navigate allegiance of powers in this corrupt moment and moments to come, I think rest is crucial. Because remember, patient endurance is not passive. We have work to do. We have engagement to be about. And so we must rest. We've heard this numerous times, right? Augustine saying, our souls are restless till they rest in you. We need time for God to put us back together so that we can endure the work together in the world. So maybe for you, that's finding a day. It's reclaiming the Sabbath practice. We had a number of students and their families who practiced this past fall and really lived into what it means to Sabbath well and take a full day, sunset to sunset, and rest and recognize our place that we're not in control of this story. Notice there's not like a beast and a beast and, oh, a family from Mars Hill fighting them. No, Christ has done that work. And while we do engage the world, God has done that whether we're with him or not. Like, Christ has done that work. So we need a place to remember our smallness, our limitedness, so that we can engage with God's unlimited love in the world. But we need to remember our place. So maybe for you it's a full day. And if that just isn't a place in your rhythm where you can do that, maybe it's something else. Maybe it's resting from the news cycle, resting away from the comment section, resting away from whatever it is that drives a franticness or corrupt political allegiance in you, to take a step back and remember our place in the story. That's the invitation for us, friends, is one of rest, patient endurance amidst the chaos and the coercion and the powers, so that we can have a right-minded view of how then to engage out of a place rested into our union with God, knowing our identity and the hope which we hold that takes us to Revelation 22. Much like rest does, it reminds us of our smallness, our limitedness. One thing I love about this meal is that we can receive it. We don't take it necessarily. We don't bake it or make it. Jesus said, I give this to you. So in the giving of this meal, friends, would we find rest to endure and even thrive in these Revelation 12 and 13 moments that we find ourselves in and will continue to? May this meal tether us to Christ, who sustains us. Like, don't miss the forest for the trees. Food, we need food to live. We need energy. This is telling us we need to be sustained so that we can endure and that we are not alone in that fight at all.